So tonight is the fourth in a series of 5 talks, 10 classes, or however many there are. People keep coming in and the guest speakers, so it kind of breaks up the momentum of what we're doing. But what we started doing is exploring what in Buddhism is called the 5 spiritual faculties, the 5 qualities of mind and heart that nourish the practice, our meditation practice, and that can be deliberately cultivated and with a great deal of intention, and that each one has a kind of robust quality to it and can be practiced on its own, as I'll describe tonight, but fits much more completely in the whole sense of the completion of practice, the whole continuum of practice. And it's dangerous, actually, to practice them, or can be, in separate fashion, because the way they work is that they feed insight. All of them together feed insight, feed the quality of wisdom and stability of mind, and get the whole thing moving in a growthful way that is not self-enhancing. And what I mean by that is that any one of these different traits, and certainly the one we're going to talk about tonight, which is concentration or samadhi, but those are two words that do not describe the same thing, they're often used to describe the same thing, but they don't mean the same thing. But when we practice them separately, like we just practice a concentration practice, then they can become corrupted and used to sort of build a sense of me in relief and in empowerment, or in some fashion that accentuates the sense of me rather than explores the sense of self. So it's very important to get a feeling of how each of these different components can do that, and that the saving grace is that all of them practice together give us the best and safest environment for a practice that is growthful and harmonious. So the practice of the 5 faculties, we started with faith, and then there is effort, and then mindfulness, and now samadhi, or concentration. And just to give you an example, you know, your effort can be so tenacious, so ambitious, so self-striving, that we're not aware what's behind the effort, feeding the effort, and it can really be a sense of self-improvement or self-aggrandizement. And the effort, with that kind of tension effort, it may not see itself in that way when you're just practicing discipline, being a very disciplined person, which is a kind of effort. You may not see that it's actually working or walking you counter to the indication of the path of meditation. So too, even mindfulness can do that, where mindfulness is, oh, you know, I have to be mindful. It's kind of a burden that we add to our already filled life, and okay, just being aware, and I don't actually know why I'm doing it, but that seems to be the right thing that everybody says I need to do, and yet somehow it's not feeding the complete understanding of the path and the journey. It's taken on as a practice in and of itself, separate from the other disciplines, separate from the other faculties. And then today we're going to approach concentration. I left out faith. Faith was the first practice we did. And if you just take faith on without the rest of the practice, it's blind faith, and you find yourself, like I was sitting on the plane coming back today, and the woman next to me was a Jehovah Witness. And it was pretty much blind faith. And I just, I really couldn't get an edge in. You know, she wasn't really interested in me. She was interested in her conversion experience. I don't know what she was interested in, but she wasn't interested in me. It was so obvious that she could care less who I was. I guess she just wanted, you know, she was so full of her own sense of faith and devotion that she just, it wasn't wanting to share it, it was wanting to, you know, sort of strangle me with it. So faith without the rest of those factors is pretty blind and can be destructive. I think we've all felt that from time to time. I told you the story of being a Buddhist monk with a Christian fundamentalist walking behind me in Bangkok arguing why I should disrobe as I was going on alms round. So now we come to concentration. Samadhi, concentration. I'm going to use those words synonymously in the beginning, but then we're going to quickly split them apart so that we see what they mean. Now, if I my intention was to bring a flashlight so that I could show you objectively what concentration was. So I'm without my flashlight, so I'm going to have to explain it. All of you know that when you sit down and you begin to follow your breath, you immediately see the impossibility of the task and your mind just starts flittering all over kingdom come. And yet, the willingness to release yourself from thought and to come back and just sustain your attention. So we're practicing both the willingness to release ourselves from our everyday thinking world and experience a new dimension of the direct experience of life firsthand. That's one thing we're doing. But the second thing we're doing is we're training in a sustaining quality of attention. Now, why would we want to do that? Why would we want an attention that could be, you know, you put it on your breath and you actually begin to see two or three or four breaths in a row, or five, or if you've done it for a while, several. Or if an emotion arises, there is the sense of being present with, attending to the emotion. Or a physical pain arises and there is the ability to move one's attention to that. Well, you can immediately see why you do that. Because if you didn't do that, you would be off thinking about it. Oh, this pain, God, I can't stand it. My God, it's that old, when is the sitting going to end? And you wouldn't be seeing the difficulty at all. You would be adding to the disturbance. An emotion would arise. You would be off playing in the field of the content and justification and analysis of the emotion, but you wouldn't be feeling the experience of the emotion. In fact, the willingness to bring our attention to the actual experience severs the normal explanations and proliferations of mind that we give our experience. So when we are able to actually make contact with an experience firsthand and directly, without thought intervening every moment, we're actually able to see the thing for what it is. Right? An emotion for what it, how it's experienced, you might say, as opposed to how the mind translates that experience into a personal problem with my boss. The personal problem with my boss stays entrenched as long as we don't have the sustaining quality of mind, we'll call it concentration, to say, oh, I know the difference between thought and the experience of what I'm having here. I know that the thinking camouflages the actual experience. It distorts the actual experience. So I'm having the actual experience of feeling an emotion. I see the component quality of thought, and my sustaining quality has a force. It's a force of mind that doesn't just take the thought and stay jabbering within oneself, but moves through the thought and sustains its attention through the thought onto the level of experience itself. Okay, I can feel this. This is okay. Feeling this. Sadness. Loneliness. And every time just saying it, loneliness, that means that a presence, the attention is on it, sustaining itself with it. There isn't room then for thought to intrude and carry us away. And it's really, the power of that is essential to the practice. There's no question for us to know the difference between what the sense data is bringing in, what the sense, the experiential sensory data is, and then the interpretation of it. The difference between those is the difference between hell and heaven. And mostly our lives are cast in purgatory because we haven't committed to either one. We're in kind of an in-between state, you might say, where I really prefer thinking, and much of my practice, if we're honest, much of my practice is spent not really effort. See, this is where effort comes in. The effort to sustain my attention, but going towards the pleasant, accommodating, and more enticing, interesting experience of thinking. Dancing with the thought. Then I think, that's not really it. So I better do some sustaining. So I spend a little time doing that. But I'm not convinced in it. My life still revolves around thought for the most part, and although I've seen some improvement from the meditation, it's not sufficient to want to relieve myself entirely from the world of extrapolation and concept and abstract. But rather, I feel come on the fence. Sometimes I'm over here, sometimes I'm over there. And we all do that. This isn't a finger-pointing session. We're all in this together. But we must remember the view from which the meditation comes from. All of these qualities, these faculties that we're practicing, can be described as sort of the four wheels of a stagecoach and the driver. That's the five. But you've got to know where you're going, right, for the stagecoach to get anywhere. Because very quickly, the practice of meditation can and will sustain your present view of yourself as being, for the most of us, being something to improve upon, something to change, because I'm not completely inside myself. I don't completely fulfilled with how I am, but a little bit of adjustment here and there, and then I just kind of ride myself on. And many traditions, many religions don't challenge that notion, but Buddhism does. At its very heart, Buddhism challenges that. The equation of Buddhism is not all my practices equal self-improvement. It's to challenge the very nature of self itself. And we have to know where we're riding this chariot or stagecoach or whatever. We have to know where this thing's going. So the motivation of what it is and how it is that we're using these faculties needs to be in place very strongly. Because if not, they're going to be filtered through the view of you and me and this and that, and division and duality and separation and loneliness and despair, which inevitably it must lead to no matter how much you self-improve. There's a crash ahead. You can beautify yourself all you want, but there's a crash that's inevitable. And if it's not now, it will be when you die. So, I just, okay, now what is this now? Is this all about me? And, you know, because when we take on the subject of concentration, it's beginning to get into, it's like a few years ago, it wasn't spoken about outside of insight practice. Those two developed together. But now, like metta practice has grown outside of insight practice. And now I'm seeing many, many people doing concentration, very deep, profound absorption states of concentration. Those absorption states are there. Those absorption states are available under the power and effort of your will. And those absorption states will take you into areas of your mind that you would not believe. Those absorption states are absorb your consciousness absorbs whatever it is that you're focused upon. I was doing a metta practice as a concentration practice, which I'll explain. And the concentration absorbed the metta. So every cell of my body was love. It is to that profound sense of the... I thought I was in a deva realm. I mean, I was like that. And you can see how enticing those states can be. Those are, I mean, if we have any sense that the practice is about achieving some refined and subtle quality, then believe me, that's a pursuable goal. That is a very pursuable goal. But it's not Buddhism. It's not what we're doing here. It simply isn't. And every state like that, I mean, in Buddhist cosmology, they have some of the people who are in the Brahma realms. They have all these realms of existence, 31 of them. And many of them are caught in those refined states of mind for eons. They don't define what an eon is, but it sounds awful long to me. And so you have to constantly watch the motivation of what we're doing. I teach a course in over Labor Day, and it's often back-to-back with a 30-day retreat of the jhana practice that Lee Brazington teaches, also at Cloud Mountain. And so many of the people who come to the Labor Day course have also set that 30 days of absorption. And I find them intractable. They are unwilling to give up that practice because of the soothing quality that the practice has brought to them. See, what it gets down to is why we're really doing this. And you find yourself in a holding pattern around what you really want. What you really want. And many of us want to be soothed. Many of us want to have the stress of our life alleviated. We want to be in suspended animation. And so you get in these states of mind, which are achievable. Lee Brazington told me that 75% of the people who And with, regardless of how much practice they've had, who do that month-long course, achieve the absorption states. So it's relatively available. But getting them out, back into insight, I would say, well, I haven't had any success. And these absorption states are now becoming the kind of in vogue thing to do. You're going to hear about them more and more and more. And there are people who are just teaching them now, like Lee. They have their place. I don't in any way want to discount the fact that they have their place. But unless you have a maturity of wisdom and a very strong sense of knowing what the practice is about, which comes from insight, which comes from abiding and verified faith, not from blind faith, then you will find yourself perhaps delaying your growth for eons. And arguing all along the way. It's true. So to understand what motivates us is a very important aspect of making this carriage move. I mean, we have to bring in the Eightfold Path no matter what we're doing. We can't do the five faculties and forget the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path governs the five faculties. It's the foundation of all teaching, right? And wise view, wise understanding is the lead, it's the lead-off hitter. It's the Ichiro of the of the Buddhist tradition. But you can get a sense as you practice this ability to concentrate. It's like a magnifying glass. You know, your the beam of your attention can get so sharp. And let me, because I want to frame this in terms of daily life. Some of you have spent much of your practice in very intense retreat settings, as I did, where the beam of your focus can get, it's like a magnification. It goes from, one power to 600 power and beyond. There's no limit. And at each turn of the microscope's power wheel, you see a new sense, a new revelation of insight at that level. Each level contains a revelation of insight. And each insight has an inducing quality in it. It's like because of the fascination and interest that comes. Now, there's no question that you need the sustaining power, but do you need 600 power? What's the power you need? 500? 400? 300? You know what you need? One. You need this power. Because the insight at every level can be as freeing as any other level. And we get into this thing of having to see things at a microscopic level. Well, how can you do that? You have to be in a very refined laboratory in order to do that. You can't do that. That's not available to anyone I know walking around Seattle for very long. It would be if you did a 6-month course and then immediately walked around Seattle. If it weren't available on this level, no one could be free. You can't go to another level, see everything you need to know, come back to this level, and then that's it. You see? I'm interested not at the 600 powers, but right here. We have to have sustaining attention, no question. We have to be willing not to move in relationship to our experience. That's fundamental, no matter what power you're on. But this willingness to have no resistance to whatever the sustaining power is showing us, so that we're not resisting. Because resistance, you see, is thought. Thought is trying to bargain its way out of this difficult situation. That's what resistance is. Here's the reality. Here's what I see. And here's my bargaining. Well, if I do this, and if I move around a little bit, or if I, you know, then I'll have a better... If I go turn on... It's all about control. So that space, that gap between the event and my wanting the event to be different is the whole problem. I don't have to see that at 600 power. I can see that right there. And I can just release myself from it. It's the release. The release. I wouldn't be teaching lay Buddhism if I didn't know that to be a fact. Is retreat helpful? Definitely. In no way am I suggesting that retreat is now... It's an environment in which you have no personal responsibility. It's an environment that's artificially created in terms of quietude. In terms of talking to one another, you have no responsibility, nothing you need to do, only look inside. What does that do? It allows you to sustain your attention without constantly being called out. And that's extremely helpful. I won't say it's essential, but it's close. At least the sincerity of heart is essential. And often that sincerity of heart is can be seasoned on retreat. When you see your life and you begin to see reflectively what your life is like and how you lose yourself in multiple ways, and you come out with a different kind of resolution and intention for your life. And that's hard to bring that intentionality in your life in the midst of all the things that are pulling you away. So listen to what I'm saying now. So I'm not dismissing retreating at all. It's a continuum of practice, and we don't have to bind ourselves to that. It's the sincerity that's the most important thing. And that sincerity revolves around what you want from your spiritual practice. It revolves around the question of motivation. In fact, someone said that all of the Dharma hinges on the pin of motivation. Why are you doing what you're doing? And you can bring sincerity to that and be honest with it and say, I'm doing it because I want to be soothed. Or I'm doing it as an experiment to see what it's like. It doesn't matter what the initial motivation is, but your sincerity to see it, and then to see the limitations of whatever that motivation is, inevitably, to see the end of that motivation, to see the value of it, what got you so far, but then to see its limitation because eventually it crashes in on itself. And then because you have built a certain sustaining power of mind, at that point, the whole thing takes on a different motivation. Often, at the end of one comes another. So, the benefits of concentration in samadhi are important to know. I can't think of a single activity that any of us do that isn't enhanced by ability to attend to it, to focus in on it, to actually be present in the doing of it. Huh? How about listening? Actually listening. Many people think they know how to listen, but to really know how to listen, you must understand what thought is. Because thought is the intrusion upon listening. And you can't get to that ability to really listen, and you may think you're a fabulous listener, until you have the sustaining quality to know that thought is intruding on a situation, which is prohibiting or distorting your listening. You see, so you can't pick a field, you can't pick an endeavor, you can't pick an activity that concentration, focus, can't enhance. And often that can be a motivating reason to get involved in this meditation, because it enhances whatever job you do and your performance within it. That's why Phil Jackson is teaching the Lakers how to meditate. That's why Time Magazine came out with its cover article this week with an actress on the front sitting in a desert. I don't know where they come up with these. It also smooths things out. I mean, when you're really focused on your breath, some of you might have noticed that there's a sort of smoothing quality. Things can get very smooth, you know, and the mind gets very subtle and very light, feathery. And there's an extraordinary peace and tranquility that comes in from that feathery quality of concentration. And that's a beautiful quality of mind and a very helpful quality of mind for being able to see. Because if you're in a lot of stress, what are you going to see? But if you're tranquil and alert, then you can see a lot, right? So you see how... But then if you love tranquility, then you're not going to want to see. You're just going to want the tranquility, you see? There's the seeing, and there's the tranquility. And if your eyes move like that, you're not going to be interested in looking through the tranquility to what you see. You see? So you see how everything can be an intrusion. It just depends on our motivation. So what's the difference between samadhi and concentration? And I feel that this is an important difference to know. Concentration picks out an object, as we've been speaking, and rests its attention on that at the exclusion of all else. Okay, so what's called one-pointed concentration would be you're at a street corner and cars are going by and you're following each car, Buick, Honda, Mercedes. It depends on what section of town you're in as to what you're but you're going to watch each car and you're going to know, you're going to follow it right on through until it's ending. Okay, so that's one-pointed concentration. Then there's moment-to-moment. Now, moment-to-moment is called moment-to-moment concentration, but I think it's a movement towards samadhi. Samadhi, I'll talk about in just a second, but moment-to-moment concentration, you're now at the corner, and you're looking out, and your gaze is steady, and you're seeing every car that passes by, following no one specific car. So your gaze is now steady, you see? You're not fixing your gaze upon something, you're steadying your gaze. And you'll find that in your meditation, as you begin to pick apart the different aspects of your mind, when you go, your different emotions, the different reactivities that you have, the different the sense of thought, and after you've looked at all of these things and felt relatively safe with them, which is one of the reasons that we can't attend to them, is we don't feel safe with them. But once we open our inward focus so that we do feel safe having these experiences, then you can relax a little bit. And when you relax a little bit, you ease the tension with each thing and your gaze becomes steady. When there is a steadiness of gaze, there's an open view. You're at the street corner and your view is open now. And you catch much more of the movement within that steadiness than you have when you're just looking at individual objects and experiences within it. Now, let us call both of those concentration, although I think the second one is beginning to move towards what I call samadhi. But let's call it concentration for a minute. Concentration can be wise or unwise. I mean, a thief is he's being very sensitive and very awake, walking through your house, focusing on each step so that he can steal from you. So to have a concentrated mind doesn't necessarily mean you have an ethical mind. Doesn't even necessarily mean you have a mind that has the view of how to use the concentration towards growth at all. It just means the mind has the ability to steady itself and hold itself on something. So you get pool sharks and people like that, you know, card players and people who have, you know, you can go any direction with it. But now we're talking about samadhi. And samadhi is a oneness of mind, is mental harmony. It's the steadiness that is inherent in the moment-to-moment concentration, but it also has clear comprehension. It has a sense of its own motivation as well. Concentration itself doesn't have a sense of its own motivation, just in the objects that it's seeing. But samadhi is a 360, not a 180. It's a whole pie. The mind is steady. It's harmonious. Sometimes it's known as mental harmony or oneness of mind or the unshakable quality of mind. It has the quality of wisdom within it, embedded within it, which is the next faculty. So you can begin to see how these faculties support one another. Now, you can move from one-pointed concentration called blind faith, verifying through one-pointed concentration to moment-to-moment concentration, which is verified faith, and to samadhi, which is abiding faith. So I'm bringing these things together. When we're in samadhi and harmony, there's natural ethics. It's not morality. It's natural ethics because you see the vision, you see the view, and you see the truth, you see the view. It's not another way of saying it is that you're not being obscured by thought. And so the view is really the view of the unknown. It's the you're holding the known within the unknown. That's the better way of saying it. I mean, I know you and I know you and I've seen you. But you can also hold that knowing without fixation, and the whole sense comes into an unknowing. And then there's an active abiding faith within samadhi. An active abiding sense At some point, what we have to do is enter that to go to the next step of the journey. So there we are. So it's just, okay. Everything is known. Cars passing. Temperature of the room. Senses are wide awake. Everything is steady. Thought is not intruding upon the harmony. And in that, what are we doing it for? The four is because of the heart. That's why we're doing it. Because we have to. The heart won't allow us not to. So we walk one-pointed concentration, looking at the breath, looking at my need, looking at my emotion, seeing it, sustaining my attention, not letting myself skip out and analyze it or justify it, which is a skipping out or anything, but just sustaining and feeling it, and it becomes safer and safer. I have less resistance to it. It backs off on its imperative, and it begins to show the field. And now I'm at the corner, and I'm seeing the moment-to-moment movement of life as my whole frame of reference becomes much steadier. And then there's another movement of which clear comprehension, in which everything is known and there's no movement towards anything. And that's samadhi. That's why samadhi is the eighth step of the Eightfold Path, because it's the last step. The mind that knows the limitation of thought does not move towards thought. And a mind that does not move towards thought abides in faith or in samadhi or in awareness. You see, you can use each one of the faculties to explain it. But it's best explained by all of them. By all of them. And the problem with just concentration itself is that it builds a sense of self-empowerment. In fact, you can build an enormous power. You can have powers that... Here's an example. I have been doing a lot of sitting. A lot of concentration. And I disrobed as a monk. I was in India. And I went to an ashram in Rishikesh. And there was I was housed in this ashram with another Westerner. And the Westerner's closet was filled with clothes. And I had one thing of clothes because I just disrobed as a monk and I had no money, and because I was a monk, I had been a monk, and so I was kind of, you know, I was kind of destitute. I had some money. So I looked in this person's closet and I saw a shirt that I really liked and said, I want him to give me that shirt. He came into the room, went over to the closet, took out the exact shirt out of 20 shirts that I had wanted, came over to me and said, I want to give you this shirt. I never did that again. It scared me to death. It absolutely scared me. I was doing this kind of an experiment, you know. But it scared me to death. There's something in me that doesn't want that kind of control over. I don't even have that kind of control over me. You can tell by the way I dress. But I sure don't want it over you. But to know that some people do, and some people can use that sense of, because it does, it makes you, it's like doing weight training. But it can't touch the mind that doesn't want anything. Some of the spiritual teachers in many traditions have enormous sense of samadhi about them, which is very alluring to many people, and they come, or to concentration about them, and then they come from that resonance of power, thinking that what it really means to be spiritual is to have that seat of power. But that doesn't have anything to do with the seat of freedom. Nothing. Nothing. Seat of freedom doesn't have any marks. Doesn't have any qualities about it because it's qualityless. I mean, there's a sense. There can be an intimation. This person has a knowing or something. But you won't see them walk on water, or you won't see any of the paraphernalia of power. So we have to be willing to look at all of our motivations for getting into practice and why we're practicing. We have to be willing to be truthful and honest enough, if we really want something, to go through that wanting and see how it has a limitation, because every wanting does. And then if you focus your energies in the way that the Buddha is addressing us, he says, what do you want? You want to be powerful? You want to be free of suffering? You want to not suffer anymore? You want to not have any more loneliness, any more despairing? You want to feel that you're not separate from everything. Well, the power of the practice is not going to take you there. So at some point, whatever the power does to you is going to have a sense of greater separation to it. And then you say, I can't, this isn't the way. This is beating my head against a wall. What I really want is my sure heart's release. What I really want is to live abiding in kindness, abiding in caring, abiding in love. That's what I really want. And I can't get it. And so I have to use the practice to see through me, you might say, so that love can then be abided within. Can we sit for a minute or two?